Cool Time with Connor Phillips. With the Heating and Bathroom Centre. From boiler to complete bathroom installation, they do it all.
I think it's fair to say that many of us didn't really pay much attention over the years to the ATP World Tour Finals down at the O2 in London. We did pay specific attention this year because Britain's Andy Murray beat five-time champion Novak Djokovic to not only win the ATP World Tour Final, but to end 2016 as world number one. And I watched quite a bit of this, but I have to be honest, I picked up a lot of my information from George Belshaw from the Metro, live tweeting from tennis. George Belshaw, first of all, congratulations with the essential live tweeting. How difficult was that?
No, thank you very much. It was pretty tough to kind of keep on top the whole time and kind of work on your own pieces while kind of keeping on top of it. But it was, I really enjoyed it. It was a nice break from sitting behind a desk.
You really got into it because, as I said at the start of the show today, I like to watch football unfold on Twitter if I can't watch it physically. Now, if it's my own team and they happen to be losing, sometimes I throw my phone in the corner and I huff like a schoolchild. That's fair enough. But the thing about watching you tweeting during the tennis, it's a very different beast because something happens almost every 10 to 15 seconds.
Yeah, and I kind of thought there was a bit of a gap in the market on it as well. A lot of people kind of just tweet every game. But in tennis, there's literally something every second going on and it is kind of unfolding every single point and ebbs and flows start. I thought it was quite exciting to try and get on top of it and keep it as live as possible.
Right, before we talk about Andy Murray's phenomenal achievement, tell me about the actual event itself, what it's like down there, how impressive it was down there, and the energy, atmosphere, and indeed the interest that was down in London for the ATP World Tour Finals. Because as I said at the start of this very chat, some people may not have known what it was some years ago.
Yeah, and I've gone as a fan for the last couple of years, and the atmosphere this year, obviously given the circumstances of Murray kind of going for world number one, was just probably twice as big as any other year. Everyone was really into it. There were some fantastic long matches. You know, Murray twice broke the record for the longest match seen at the event during the week, and there were really kind of forwards and backwards big unpredictable matches that the crowd just really got into. Everyone was really hyped, and on Sunday particularly, the noise when Djokovic and Murray came out, they almost blew the roof off. It was absolutely unbelievable. The thing is about this event, it's very, very different from your standard kind of Grand Slams where you kind of sit quietly, almost a bit kind of like golf. You can applaud at the end of the points and stuff, but generally it's really silent. And while it's quiet in the points here, the atmosphere is very kind of party, lots of music blaring out, fans kind of getting into it, and it's a really kind of unique event throughout the year. In terms of like crowd and walking around, you know, it's all indoors, which again is quite different from your Grand Slams that are outdoors, and it's based in the centre of London, big kind of shopping malls all around. It's kind of a big, almost like an American sports event in a way, the way it's kind of set up, and it's definitely worth going to if you've not been before.
Novak Djokovic winning this tournament 4 years on the bounce, and the Serb was looking to equal Roger Federer's record of 6 titles. Could still maybe happen, but it's not going to happen on the bounce. I understand you're the only British journalist to get in front of Novak Djokovic and talk to him about his journey to this position, and to talk to him as a world number two.
Yes, we spoke to him as a world number two that, you know, it's been very rare to kind of see him in that position over the last 5 years. Like Djokovic has really dominated this sport, and particularly the kind of indoor scene at the end of the season. I think he'd only lost one match in his last 23 before Sunday, which again is just shows what an incredible achievement it was for Murray. The thing I would say is his performance on Sunday was pretty sloppy by his standards. I'd say that's probably as badly as I've ever seen him play in, kind of inverted commas, a big match. He's had some trouble in the last 6 months. As he said himself in the kind of press conferences afterwards, he was very reflective, saying how he'd won the French Open earlier in the year, which was his kind of the last Grand Slam he hadn't won before. And he didn't really get a chance to kind of reflect. He kind of goes straight into Wimbledon, and he's kind of kept going on and just really not found that kind of fire since. And I think that really showed against Murray on Sunday.
How does he go from being so consistent, being world number one, being unbeatable, to dropping down to, okay, it is only number two in the world, as you said, had a rough season playing sloppy matches? Is that down to the people who are around him? Surely he knows himself as a professional athlete, the world number one athlete, one of the most successful tennis players of all time, what he's doing wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I think at top level sport, we're talking about a couple of points all the time for these tennis guys. There's not that much in these matches that go from a win to a loss, and a lot of it's purely on that mentality and that kind of belief. And Djokovic just didn't have it against Murray. You know, he said himself after the match, every time he set up a good point, he'd miss that kind of final shot where he'd put him away. And he, you know, rightly or wrongly, he will be looking inwards at his own team, his own setup, and he'll be thinking, right, I need to change something. And before Becker came in, Djokovic was on another slump and hadn't kind of been at his best, and he brought in a guy who he thought could get him over the line in the big matches. It might just be the case that that was the boost he needed then, and that kind of run its course now. And Becker was never necessarily a long-term option. You know, Marion Vida is his kind of main coach, who's been with him for probably a decade now. He'll stay, and that'll be the kind of staple, but he'll probably mix it up and see if he can find a fresh influence, a fresh insight, and try and mix things up again.
Full time with Connor Phillips, with the Heating and Bathroom Centre. From boiler to complete bathroom installation, they do it all.
Let's get on to the next section of the show, as promised. Now, this weekend that has just gone, Newcastle took on Leeds United, two former giants in English League football, and two clubs that the late, great Gary Speed played for. And of course, as we are, Rock Sport and Talk for Liverpool, Everton were obviously very strongly linked with Gary Speed, having played and captained the Blues as well. And Lee Ryder from the Newcastle Evening Chronicle was able to have a little look at the game over the weekend and see what it meant to Lee's family and what it meant to football fans worldwide. First of all, Lee, we'll start with that. A really fitting tribute to Gary Speed and his career over the weekend.
Yeah, very emotional. Obviously, big player at Newcastle and Leeds, obviously, and Everton as well. I think both sets of fans were immaculate, really, throughout that. I mean, they were taunting each other during the game, but for that 1 minute, it was everyone stood together. It was quite a nice moment.
Yeah, the T-shirts made as well in his memory. It's strange that both teams are now playing in the second tier of English football, because it would be very special to see this happen at another level as well, and getting a little bit more, I suppose, prowess from across the world. But it was nice.
Yeah, I mean, it was good. I mean, obviously, it's been around on all the websites now, so I think people have had, you know, it's been on social media, so I think everyone's been able to have a look at it and you know, see what such a special tribute it was. Obviously, Gary's parents were there as well, which was they were obviously very emotional, and I know that his dad used to love the trips up to Newcastle. And they're obviously very good friends with, you know, a former Newcastle coach, John Carver, as well, who was very close to Gary. So I think it was a day, really, where he was remembered. I mean, obviously, Newcastle, you know, got the result. And, you know, in the end, they keep the promotion race pushing on.
Yeah, indeed. And we'll talk about Newcastle at length in a second. Just first of all, a little chat about Leeds and what they brought to Newcastle over the weekend. Leeds in seventh place now. A little bit of consolidation within this Leeds side. They've brought some experienced players in. They have kept hold of a few players that, well, I suppose, almost tried to escape over the summer. But it has done them the world of good. Seventh, and it wasn't clear cut for Newcastle this weekend by any means.
No, I mean, I think with Leeds, you know, the last, I think, since they from the Premier League, they've had a hell of a time, really. Been down to League One, of course. Been through a succession of owners, managers, administration, and I do genuinely feel for the the Leeds faithful. But, you know, they seem to be recovering a little. I just hope Gary Monk's allowed to manage and, you know, there's no overreaction and he can get on with his job because, you know, he's a good guy and he's a good manager. It wasn't easy for Newcastle, obviously. I think perhaps the first 20 minutes, I think maybe Leeds possibly paid Newcastle a bit too much respect and obviously Newcastle grabbed the lead. The sort of last 15 minutes of the half, though, Newcastle pinned back lots of corners. It was almost like the equaliser was, you know, on its way, but the half-time whistle coming. Thankfully, we went in with 1-0 lead and then come out second half, scored early, and that really just finished the game from Newcastle's point of view, and probably should have had, you know, maybe another goal or two.
Lee, but, if you're standing close to a hill or some sort of antenna, grab onto it there. We're just leaving you. You're dropping out ever so slightly there. But I tell you what, I'll address another couple of questions and see if the joys of mobile phone signal let us down or not. But Rafa Benitez went in there to do a job this season. First couple of weeks of the season, you and I spoke on this very show about the fact that, you know, this might not be as clear-cut a job as Rafa may have suspected. He said, look, bear with me, we will consolidate, we will bring in the players, we will get the results. And it has to be said, Rafa is a man of his word. 23-plus goal difference, 40 points in the bag already, only 17 games played. Is it exciting times at Newcastle? Because this is kind of the regroup that you needed.
Absolutely. I think, you know, last season got relegated. We jumped down in the end. It was very close run thing. Rafa almost saved Newcastle. But, you know, this season, we've never really looked back. You know, we did have a bit of a shaky start, but Rafa's, you know, addressed that. Maybe that was the best thing that could have happened to him in some ways. Manage the expectation. And here we are with 40 points at the top of the table and looking very good indeed.
Full time with Connor Phillips. With the Heating and Bathroom Centre. From boiler to complete bathroom installation, they do it all.
Let's get into the football over the weekend. David Downey from the Blue Room joins me. Seamus Coleman's late goal denied Swansea a first victory under manager Bob Bradley as their winless streak stretched to 11 games. I tried to follow the game, watch the game again, watch the highlights of the game, and I think the game to me was summed up by my own timeline on Twitter from our Everton contributors, yourself, and people's view on it. It was a very, very negative, dare I say, atmosphere from the outset in this game.
There was no atmosphere. I wouldn't say it was negative. It was negative at half time, and no surprise, the team was booed off 1-0 down. And really nothing to shout about whatsoever in the first half. Balassi had a chance, which he should really stick away. The keeper's already on the floor and he somehow manages to hit it at him. It was abject, really, and it was scarily like something you'd see from last season, aside from the defensive blunders than the fact that Jagielka, I think, is... it's sad to say because he's been a fantastic servant for Everton, he's been a fantastic player, but, I mean, I'm not sure who it was. I think it was Jamie Carragher who once said, when your legs are gone as a defender, they're gone. And it's starting to look that way with him. I mean, that's the third penalty he's given away this season. He looks a shadow of his former self. Also a shadow of a leader as well, because he's, I think, a man of his stature, a defender of his stature, influences so many people around him that a lot of people look to him to be the leader of the side. And when he's throwing in performances like that, then, you know, it's difficult for him to have that authority as a captain. And particularly when you've got someone like Ashley Williams, who's still at the peak of his powers next to him. You sort of wonder if we're sort of backing the wrong horse type of thing in terms of the captaincy stakes.
Let's have a quick chat about Liverpool. Sangi, first of all, so frustrating. It was one of those days that when a few so-called easy chances didn't find the back of the net, you raised your eyebrows and you went, actually, this might not be Liverpool's day.
Yeah, and you know what? I only saw the highlights. It was one of those... It was one of those games that there's two sorts of views I've got on it. It was either coming, you can look at it like that, where they've been that clinical that it was coming, or you can look at it like a little bit like the Hull. Was it the Hull game?
Burnley.
Burnley, sorry. The game at Anfield recently, 6.
Oh, the 6-1.
Watford.
Watford,
not Hull, Watford.
It took 15 minutes for them to get going in that game.
But where they had a few chances and you're thinking, as soon as one goes in, it's floodgates time, and it just, for whatever reason, at Southampton, it didn't come. And I think, you know, you look at that and you think, that's the time when you think, if it was Daniel Sturridge, it's the time you sort of glance over to the bench and you maybe have a little wish of, I wish he had that. I wish that was him who had the ball at his feet there. Because you're thinking there's probably two or three chances. But he picks his team. They've been magnificent thus far. Why would you change? But I have to admit that you do look over and you think, what would have happened if he was on the pitch? But then maybe lends way to him starting next time. Who knows?
But then again, it's Philippe Coutinho, that's the one that sits in my memory, the obvious or the glaring miss, if you like. And
Firmino, you know, had a great chance. Firmino, I always come Firmino because I love it. Firmino had a great chance as well outside of his foot.
But then again,
past the post,
they're the three you'd put your mortgage on: Sturridge, Firmino, and Coutinho.
Well, Sturridge didn't miss one. I mean, Sturridge hangs the ball up for Klein. It's a great ball, by the way. Absolutely hangs it up back post.
Sitting on that arm.
Yeah, and I think that's the one that sapped Liverpool a little bit. I was talking to someone on one of our shows before, Rob, who went. I didn't go down, but Rob went, and he said, and it's a great point that he makes, which is, and it's something you forget, that he effectively felt as though he celebrated three goals. There's one that Matip misses when it's whizzed across the box, there's the Firmino one, and then there's the Klein one. And three times he's got the emotional, it's in, and then the fall of, it's not in. And that happens not just to the supporters, but it also happens to Liverpool players. When you play and you think that's in, and you have that. And I think it's the Klein one, which is finally a bit of a killer for them. But yeah, up to that point,
up to that point,
you felt like it's coming. I think when you watch the game back in the cold light of day, that's the one where there isn't another good chance after that point, and where Liverpool maybe, if I say they did well to escape with the points, my point would be that there wasn't even an easy chance that they give away in the last 15 minutes of the game. Southampton can't get in the Liverpool box, let alone exploit the fact that Liverpool are maybe a bit demoralised by that point, because that's what happens when you play. That's just what happens when you think we should be winning here and it's not come. You know, it gets in your head a little bit. So I think that's the one. But then it's fallen to a right back. It's not as though it's fallen to, even to James Milner. Even if it was on the other flank, he might be a little bit more. Nathaniel Klein will get, three, four goals for Liverpool this season, max. He's not going to necessarily, you could do with him popping up for that one. But
do we look at the Southampton defence, who have been lauded in the media this weekend, and give them some kudos?
Give them a bit of credit, but I also think that I thought Southampton defended really well as a side, especially first half, and they also got themselves out of jail a couple of times. Van Dijk makes a really good recovery tackle for the Coutinho one where Coutinho's in. Fonte comes across from nowhere. I actually think that quietly Fonte's the one who's underrated. For me, it's no surprise. You know, I think a lot of people were saying around Lovren, Liverpool might have bought the wrong one. Yeah. Van Dijk does bigger things in a football match, but Fonte's just there playing centre-back, making minimum of fuss. I think he's a really impressive footballer, and he's been doing that now for three or four seasons. It's not just like he's having a good run, but Van Dijk looks a good player as well. But there's, you know, they defended well, but we've just talked about Liverpool really could have scored three. We wouldn't all be, and this is the fine margins of football, we wouldn't all be sitting here saying Southampton defended well if Liverpool had scored three. We wouldn't be saying that, and Liverpool really could have just scored three, one of which is from a set piece. Conversely, we're also saying that, Liverpool maybe didn't create quite as many chances as we'd like, but they could have scored three, and we wouldn't be sitting here saying, oh, well, they scored three there, they could have done much better. So it's the strangeness of the game that there are these fine margins, and Southampton dug in, but I think the key thing is how dominant Liverpool were in the second 45 minutes. Southampton only managed to pass the ball to one another 86 times in 45 minutes in that second half, and that's a side that prides itself on the fact that it keeps the ball, it knocks it round. Romelu, who's had games this season in centre mid where he's made on his own more than 86 passes, but in one half his whole side only made 86 passes, completed 86 passes in a half of football.
Did it feel, we'll talk about this at length straight after this break, did it feel, in a word, like a loss?
No, it didn't, because I think when you get beat, you feel like you've got beat in terms of the fact that you haven't played well. For me, it feels like 2 points dropped, but that's not the same as a defeat.
Sangi, in a word as well, did it feel like a loss from Liverpool perspective?
I missed that bit.
I'd say yeah.